Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with a radio program and podcast that aims to help you learn and improve your American English skills. We do this by presenting interesting and important stories in a way that is easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have a special program for you. It is about a woman who says her religious beliefs will not let her do a part of her state government job. The question is, does the U.S. Constitution protect her, or can she be required to do everything that she was hired to do? To help explain a complicated subject, here is Ann Ball.
Hundreds of supporters cheered when a local government official, Kim Davis, was released from jail Tuesday. She smiled and appeared to cry.
I just want to give God the glory.
Ms. Davis is a clerk who works in a small-town government office in Kentucky that issues marriage licenses. She has declared that she will not sign licenses for marriages between people of the same gender. That is a violation of U.S. law. Ms. Davis has become a celebrity at the center of the debate in the U.S. about religious freedom and civil liberties. She says her religion, she is an apostolic Christian, disagrees with same-sex marriage. Her job in a secular government includes signing licenses that permit eligible couples to marry. Since June, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that gay marriage was legal across the country, Ms. Davis has refused to sign marriage licenses for anyone. Her refusal is a protest against gay marriage. Supporters say Ms. Davis is acting on her First Amendment rights. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Linda Prevashevsky is a history professor at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. The university was founded by a sect of Catholics focused on education and research. She says, Americans' understanding of religious freedom has changed since the First Amendment was approved in 1791. In the 18th century, Ms. Prevashevsky says, many state judges supported the idea that laws should promote morality.
And in order to do that amongst your people, you need religious faith. And to their minds, almost all the time, it's Christianity and it's Protestantism.
But in the past 100 years, federal courts have heard more and more cases about whether states violate citizens' religious liberties. For example, Ms. Prevashevsky says, Jews objected to state laws requiring them to close their stores on Sunday, or Catholics objected to laws requiring them to read a Protestant version of the Bible. Over time, judges in the late 19th and 20th centuries said some of those issues needed to be confronted. They had to judge how to balance how religion was practiced in a secular nation. Ms. Prevashevsky notes that Religious beliefs and political issues have clashed many times in history. Slavery and marriage have been persistent issues. These disputes are part of a society that includes people of many faiths, she says. At the same time, she says, the government must afford all its citizens equal rights. Josh Earnest is a spokesperson for President Barack Obama. He spoke to reporters about this issue.
Every elected official in this country is subject to the rule of law, and that is a founding principle of our democracy.
In other words, says Mr. Earnest, Americans may not choose which laws to follow. The federal judge who ruled on Ms. Davis's case, David Bunning, says she is required to follow the law, including the law that permits gay marriage. In addition, the judge points out that he, like Ms. Davis, is a government official. He says his promise to serve the public means he cannot permit his personal beliefs to interfere with his job. Protesters also note that Ms. Davis has been married 4 times. Her personal history conflicts with the apostolic Christian belief that marriage is only between one man and one woman. Ms. Davis, who is 49 years old, says she became an apostolic Christian 4 years ago. She worked in the Rowan County Clerk's Office for 27 years and was elected county clerk last November. Ms. Davis says God's law conflicts with her job. You can't be separated from something that's in your heart and in your soul, she told the judge. Ms. Davis, who earns about $80,000 a year as an elected official, says she plans to return to work in a few days. Many Republican politicians have opinions on Ms. Davis and her case. When she left the jail Tuesday, Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee stood at Ms. Davis's side. Another Republican presidential candidate, Ted Cruz, said he was planning to visit Ms. Davis in jail. Both Mr. Huckabee and Mr. Cruz identify themselves with evangelical Christianity, which is similar to apostolic Christianity. They believe that the Christian Bible is God's Word, and that people can be born again and go to heaven if they accept God's teaching. Evangelical Christians also often talk publicly or proselytize about their Christian beliefs. A study in May 2015 by the Pew Research Center found that about 70% of Americans identify as Christian. That number of Christians has dropped 8 points since 2007. About 25% of Christians in the U.S. are evangelical, the study said. 6% practice religions other than Christianity, and 23% do not have a connection to any organized religion. Judge David Bunning released Ms. Davis from jail after less than a week. Other court clerks in Ms. Davis's office are signing marriage licenses. Judge Bunning says Ms. Davis may not block marriage licenses. Ms. Davis's lawyers are asking for her to be able to continue her job without approving any marriage licenses. They do not want her name on any official document that permits same-sex couples to get married. The governor says Only the legislature can make that decision. The legislature meets next in January 2016. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. We would like to know how you feel about this story. Please write to us or send an email soon.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Much of the western United States is suffering from extreme drought conditions. U.S. officials are blaming the lack of rainfall and snow for wildfires and water shortages. The long drought has influenced changes around an increasing number of homes in Southern California. More and more people there are removing traditional garden plants and replacing them with plants that need less water. Jan Muntz is one of those homeowners. She says it has not been easy to replace the plants in her yard.
It's very painful, and some of these plants have been there probably 80 and 90 years.
Many plants in the Los Angeles area do not grow there naturally. In other words, they are non-native plants. Some require lots of water. The Theodore Payne Foundation has been working for years to educate Californians about plants that are native to the state. Kitty Connolly works for the group. She says there has been a sharp increase in the number of people who want to learn about indigenous plants.
You use less water. So in a California native garden, depending on how you plant, you'll save 50 to 80% of water over a conventional garden.
The foundation operates a nursery where people learn how to grow and care for native plants. Scientists are now predicting some weather changes in the American West. Bill Patzert is a climatologist, a scientist who studies the climate. He predicts rain will fall in Southern California this winter.
This looks very, very promising for a down payment on drought relief in the American West. We're very hopeful for this El Nino.
The El Nino weather event produces warmer than average waters in the Pacific Ocean near Earth's equator. Scientists expect this weather pattern will be very strong, beginning at the end of this year and continuing into next year. Mr. Patzert notes that El Nino also has an effect on other areas.
Some areas that are normally dry, like the American West, Peru and Ecuador, get torrential rains. In Southeast Asia, Indonesia and the Philippines and Northern Australia, they get punishing droughts. Even in South Africa, they get droughts. And so there isn't one continent that doesn't feel the footprint of a big El Nino.
El Nino lasts for about a year, but another weather pattern is forming and could last much longer. It is called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or PDO. Nate Matua is a research scientist. He told VOA on Skype that the PDO could produce warming and cooling patterns for many years.
The warm pattern of the PDO favors above normal rainfall in Southern California and throughout the southwest part of the U.S. and northern Mexico. So it would favor a break in these dry conditions for the southwest.
Mr. Mantua notes weather is unpredictable. He says the southwestern United States may have only 1 year of rain. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell the story of how a British attack on Fort McHenry in the port of Baltimore led to the Star-Spangled Banner, America's national anthem. In the summer of 1814, British forces attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol building, the White House, and other public buildings. Then they withdrew to their ships in the Chesapeake Bay. British General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn led the attack on Washington. Next, they planned to attack Baltimore. But the people of Baltimore expected the attack and began to prepare for it. 50,000 of them built defenses around the city. The port of Baltimore was protected by Fort McHenry. The guns and cannon of the fort could prevent British ships from reaching the city. The British began with a land attack against Baltimore. General Ross, Admiral Cockburn, and about 4,000 British soldiers landed at North Point, a finger of land reaching into the Chesapeake Bay. From North Point, it was a march of about 22 kilometers to Baltimore. The British began marching at about 7 in the morning. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn stopped their men after an hour. The two commanders and several of their officers rode to a nearby farmhouse and forced the family living there to give them breakfast. When the British officers finished eating, the farmer asked General Ross where the British were going. To Baltimore, he answered. The farmer told Ross that he might have some difficulty getting there because of the city's defenses. But the British general replied, "I will eat supper in Baltimore or in hell." When they returned to the march, Ross and Cockburn moved far in front of the British forces. A group of several hundred Americans opened fire on the British officers. Ross was hit. He died soon afterward. The Americans retreated, but they slowed the progress of the British soldiers. It was late the next day before the British force arrived to face the Army of Americans near Baltimore. The Americans were on high ground and had about 100 cannon to fire down on the British. The British commander ordered his men to rest for the night. He sent a message to the British warships to attack the city with guns and mortars. Such an attack, he felt, might cause the Americans to fall back. But the British ships had already been firing at Fort McHenry since early morning. The British guns were more powerful than those of the fort. The strength of their guns let the ships fire from so far away that the American guns could not hit them. Shells and bombs from British mortars fell like rain over Fort McHenry, but few Americans in the fort were hurt or killed. Most of the rockets and shells exploded in the air or missed. Many of them failed to explode. At the center of the fort flew a large American flag. The flag could be seen by the soldiers defending the city and by the British warships. The flag was also seen by a young American named Francis Scott Key. Key was a lawyer who had once thought of a life of religious work. He was also a poet and writer. He opposed war, but he loved his country and joined the army in Washington to help defend it. When the British withdrew from Washington, they took an American doctor named William Beans with them. Francis Scott Key knew the doctor and asked President Madison to request the British commander to release him. President Madison wrote the request, and Key agreed to carry it to Admiral Cockburn. Key also carried letters from wounded British soldiers in American hospitals. In one of the letters, a British soldier told of the excellent medical care he was being given. Cockburn agreed to free the doctor after he read the reports that his wounded men were receiving good medical care. But Cockburn would not permit the doctor or Key or a man who came with him to return to land until after the attack. So Francis Scott Key watched from a British warship as the shells and rockets fell on Fort McHenry. Years later, he said, "I saw the flag of my country waving over a city, the strength and pride of my native state, a city devoted to plunder and desolation by its assailants. I witnessed the preparation for its assaults. I saw the array of its enemies as they advanced to the attack. I heard the sound of battle. The noise of the conflict fell upon my listening ear and told me that the brave and the free had met the invaders." All through the rainy day, the attack continued. Dr. Beans, watching with Key, had difficulty seeing the flag. He kept asking if the stars and stripes still flew above the fort. Until dark, Key could still see it. After that, he could only hope. Britain tried to land another force of men near the fort, but the Americans heard the boats and fired at them. The landing failed. Shells and rockets continued to rain down on Fort McHenry. At times, the fort's cannon answered. That told Key that the Americans had not surrendered. The British troops east of Baltimore spent most of the night trying to keep dry. Commanders could not decide if they should attack or retreat. Finally, orders came from the admiral: withdraw to your ships. A land attack against Baltimore's defenses would not be attempted. At first light of morning, British shells were still bursting in the air over the fort. The flag had holes in it from the British shells, but it still flew. The British shelling stopped at 7 o'clock. Key took an old letter from his pocket, and on it he wrote a poem about what he had seen. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Americans sang these words and remembered the attack on Fort McHenry. Then, in 1931, Congress made the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. The unsuccessful British attack on Baltimore was followed by news that Britain had also suffered a defeat to the north. British General George Prevost had led 11,000 soldiers south from Montreal to New York. At Plattsburgh, on the western shore of Lake Champlain, his army was opposed by fewer than 4,000 Americans. General Prevost believed he needed to get control of the lake before moving against the American defenders. He requested the support of 4 British ships and about 10 gunboats. A similar-sized group of American ships also entered the lake. In a fierce battle, the American naval force sank the British ships. The army decided not to attack without naval support. The 11,000 British soldiers turned around and marched back to Montreal. By the time of these battles, the United States and Britain had already agreed to discuss peace. The peace talks began in the summer at Ghent in Belgium. At first, the British were in no hurry to sign a peace treaty. They believed their forces would be able to capture parts of the United States. Britain demanded as a condition for peace that the United States give large areas of its northwest to the Indians. It also said America must give Canada other areas along the border. And Britain would not promise to stop seizing American sailors and putting them in the British Navy. But British policy at the peace talks changed after the battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh. The end of the War of 1812 will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.